The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show EDU edition for this week. This is the show I've been, I don't know, warning you about, but we've been letting you know we have a very special guest on today. In addition to Jim, who's pretty much always with us, he'll speak here in a moment. But more importantly, we've got Dr. Wade Pfau joining us today. For those who don't know, Dr. Pfau is the program director of the Retirement Income Certified Professional Designation and professor of retirement income at the American College of Financial Services in Pennsylvania. He's also the co-director of the college's Center for Retirement Income. He's also the principal and director for McLean Asset Management. He holds a doctorate in economics from Princeton University. He's published more than 60 peer-reviewed research articles. He hosts the Retirement Researcher website and is a contributor on lots of places, especially now on the official book tour, I guess you might say. But we're lucky enough to have him here after the release of his latest or newest book, Retirement Planning Guidebook, Navigating the Important Decisions for Retirement Success. So thanks for joining us, Dr. Pfau. Or is Wade okay?
Yeah, thank you, Chris. Thanks, Jim. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. Well, we've been excited to have you. We've thought for quite a few years, we've followed what you've done and a lot of what you describe more academically most of the time we employ in our process here. Before I forget to mention it, Kevin Lyles is a friend of ours as well. He's been on the show a couple of times. He was nice enough to connect us, and I heard that he did some editing on your book as well. So he chipped in on your latest book.
Right. He was the third layer of copy editing, and he found a lot of mistakes still after I tried to read it out loud, word for word, looking for any typos. And since Kevin read it, I've only heard about one more typo that came in.
So yeah, I heard you mention that on another podcast. So I've taken that as a personal challenge. I haven't found one yet, but I'm not all the way through the book.
There is one in chapter 10. Well hidden. It was a two-letter word that has one of the letters is wrong.
Got it. Well, I'll watch for one. For you to put out a book with this many pages and you've only had one reader report an issue, that's very impressive by itself. But reason why I heard that, I was actually listening to or watching, now that it's in video format, Roger Whitney's Retirement Answer Man podcast last week. And that's where you were talking about Kevin. And I wanted to point out, this is new to Jim. This will get him talking. Roger Whitney used the phrase minimum dignity floor on his podcast. Yeah. That's he didn't provide any attribution to us, which the Jim, the originator of the phrase minimum dignity floor. So I'd wanted to point that out to Jim. I just ran across that as I was watching that podcast earlier today in preparation for Wade being on the show.
Interesting. My attorneys will speak to his attorney.
So that's our terminology. I think, I mean, you picked up on it when you were talking to Roger, but that's our terminology for what you might call your base most critical expenses that you must meet through retirement. So we refer to it here as the minimum dignity floor. It's the first time I've heard it outside of the walls of our studio, if you will. So,
but one thing we do, Wade, on that is we don't, or at least Chris and I, when we created it, we don't mean the minimum amount to keep you out of poverty. We mean kind of what I think you refer to in your book as lifestyle. So we feel the minimum dignity floor is food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare expenses. So anyways, I don't want to get too deep into what we do. Our listeners know that. But I just wanted to add a little bit of clarity to what Chris is talking about when he mentions minimum dignity floor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we're on the same page. It's like, what are your essentials? And then
essentials,
what's more
yes.
discretionary on top of that?
Right. So I think the first thing we wanted to get to here, because it's kind of a, you know, you have several books, obviously. A lot of our listeners will have read through some of your books. The RISA matrix, although I need clarification on your preferred pronunciation of that acronym. Is it RISA or RISA or...
We say RISA.
That's probably good because when I first said it out loud, I thought, my gosh, we're going to confuse this with ERISA all the time. So RISA, that's a good idea. So why don't you explain to our listeners what this retirement income style awareness is all about and why it's maybe important for you as a person entering retirement or thinking about retirement to identify maybe where you fall in the four quadrants of this matrix that you've constructed?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's something that's really been in the back of my mind for a long time in terms of ever since I started looking at financial planning and retirement planning, it seemed like there were these completely opposite ways that people would talk about issues. And you could ask basic questions like, is there a safe withdrawal rate? Is there a role for annuities? Do stocks become less risky after longer holding periods and so forth? And get completely opposite answers. And that's really been a hallmark of retirement. There are different strategies that can be used, whether it's like a total return investing strategy, a bucketing or time segmentation strategy, income protection, which is about building a reliable income floor, kind of that minimum dignity floor that you discuss, using simple income annuities or what we call risk wrap, which is building that floor, but using more like deferred annuities with living benefits and that sort of thing. There's different styles to approaching retirement income. And so the RISA, it's a questionnaire that's meant to help guide people to understand as a starting point for their retirement conversation, what sort of style resonates best with you? Are you a total return investor? Do you prefer to have an income protection, like a reliable income floor for your retirement? Do you resonate with the idea of time segmentation, which is about using bonds for short-term expenses and then having a growth portfolio to cover longer-term expenses? There's different strategies, and where the whole idea of the RISA is to just provide that starting point to help people understand what kind of strategy might work best for their personal situation. Because that's an important point that I'm agnostic. Any of these strategies are viable. It's not that there's one superior strategy for everyone. And then to just try to help people get a better understanding of what might work best for their personality, profile, and style to have the most successful retirement.
Yeah, I think that's a great point that any of these could work. Any done well are viable, and the style needs to match your personality as much as anything, and in your outlook on how you would feel comfortable moving through this new thing that that we call retirement. I will point out to people that those who want to kind of go through this profiling to see where they might fall in this, it's essentially a matrix of these four quadrants. You have an online quiz, if you will, questionnaire that will help people identify the style that seems to fit the way they look at the topics related to retirement. So I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think people can get to that if they go to risaprofile.com, which is risaprofile.com/guidebook. And that link is in your book. So I figured it was for public consumption. And from there, they can actually go through. You estimated on there a 45-minute questionnaire It took me a little while. It took me shorter than that, but it was pretty comprehensive. And I will tell you, there was one page where it felt like an SAT test. That I don't know if that was intentional.
That numeracy section, probably.
Yeah, there was a section where it was asking me to do calculations, and I'm thinking, wow, this is a little bit more stress than I thought I signed up for. But if you go to that risaprofile.com/guidebook, you can kind of walk through this and see on your own where you might kind of fall in the spectrum of safety first to probability based, and then your idea of this committed versus optionality preference that you've got. Those are essentially the axes on your matrix. I will tell you, I went to that guidebook and I took that test to see where we'd fall. When I say we, I meant a typical person who enjoys our show, listens to our show, and maybe engages with us for retirement planning. I guessed where typical clients of ours would fall, and I was pretty darn close. It actually turned out, for those listeners who are familiar with our approach, we're kind of in between the two safety first quadrants, if you will, not a full commitment, but kind of on that line between the two left boxes on your quadrant there. Because we do embrace this idea of protection of the minimum dignity floor with secure income. Secure income, again, is our term for things like annuities, Social Security, pensions, that sort of thing. So I wanted to point that out on the RISA profile for those who wanted to do their own thing and actually check it. Do you, from that, once you have that result, do you think it's best used maybe to find help or an advisor or doing your own thing based on that? Or if you're already working with someone, take that information to that advisor or planner and see if they can put together a plan based on that? Do you think most planners and advisors are flexible enough where they could accommodate people in any of the four quadrants?
I think most advisors at this stage are not flexible to accommodate all four quadrants. And that's part of this ongoing debate in financial services, that people tend to specialize. Like a lot of traditional investment managers are only going to service that the total return strategy, which is just using a aggressive investment portfolio and relying on the stock market to fund retirement. Other advisors who are more from the insurance world might focus more on just the more protected income type strategies. I do think advisors ultimately need to decide or recognize the viability of any of these strategies. Now, whether or not a given advisor needs to service all the different profiles is up to that advisor, but to then at least be open to the idea that, right, as you're saying, if somebody takes the RISA and really figures out they have a style that's diametrically opposed to the advisor they're working with, they might want to consider whether that advisor can really accommodate them in an appropriate way, or if they should consider changing advisors if they do have a good match already. And I think a lot of people can naturally self-select, so that hopefully they do have a good match already, but then that can just further reconfirm that they've made the right decision and is working with somebody who can really help provide the type of strategy that works best for them. Part of that, this was the whole research survey. The RISA doesn't necessarily have to be so long, but this is kind of the research version of it with that numeracy quiz and everything else. But it also talks about the financial implementation. And to get a sense of, are you someone who has retirement income self-efficacy, which is, do you feel comfortable doing these things? And I would imagine that a lot of people that listen to podcasts about retirement will tend to have that self-efficacy, that they'll feel comfortable making decisions related to retirement income. And then also about how they perceive advisors' usefulness net of the cost of working with an advisor. Are you someone who tends to perceive greater value, or maybe you're fine doing it on your own? You're more self-directed. You don't necessarily see the additional value of working with an advisor. But then that can help you get a sense too, that if you are somebody who can feel like you're comfortable doing this on your own, you may be a collaborator if you perceive advisor usefulness and still work with an advisor, or you might be a do-it-yourself, self-directed type person. Otherwise, you might also be someone who maybe doesn't have self-efficacy for retirement. You want to delegate that to have the advisor do it for you, or maybe you're more of a validator looking for more of a one-time plan. So after taking the RISA, you'll have a sense both how you want to build your plan out in terms of what type of advisory relationship or self-directed, as well as then what's the strategy that seems to resonate with your style? Like, do you, are you going to consider annuities as part of that? Are you going to be investments only? But you now have that basis for thinking about it.
Mm-hmm. Maybe kind of a one-off question here that just came to mind, because it's something that we struggle with all the time. There's a lot of advisors just moving towards kind of a fee-only type of a structure to really try to abandon the AUM fee structure. And one of the challenges we run into, those who aren't, I would call it annuity aversion disorder, who just absolutely will not have a discussion about annuities. There's just not a lot of those types of products, if they're attractive in a particular case, that are available for a fee-only advisor. Do you see that industry kind of moving more towards accommodating those who might want to provide financial planning advice on a fee-only type basis, so they can't be involved in a typical commission-structured insurance product? Are the insurance companies kind of embracing that to help those of us who are more agnostic on different approaches and maybe to include annuities? What, do you have any insight into the direction the industry might be going there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there is a lot of growth in that aspect of financial planning, because as you're saying, a traditional investment manager who charges a percentage of assets under management, they were usually highly incentivized to avoid annuities because they would have to give up those assets and could no longer charge a fee on them. And at the same time as well, if they were fee only, so that they can only accept fees from their client, most annuities historically had a payout based on a commission to the advisor. And so they could not only would they lose assets, but they also couldn't even accept the commission on the annuity. So it was really a non-starter. But now we do have fee-only annuities. They have been developed. They do not pay commissions. They can be built into the practice of a financial advisor who works on a fee-only basis and who does an assets under management approach, and to be able to manage those annuity assets in the same manner as they manage the stock and bond portfolios as well. So those options are growing, and we're seeing more of that. And I think in the future, we'll see a lot more of it as well, because it allows for someone who's historically been an investment manager and who therefore is either total return or time segmentation to also be able to offer annuities to clients as well when it's appropriate and can fit that client's style.
Well, since we got on this topic, I want to just throw a little bit in, Wade, on this, because I know, and the firm I'm about to mention, you've heard about them. You've spoken online for this firm a lot, but it's a wholesaling firm that specializes in fee-based annuities for advisors. I'm sure you can figure out the firm I'm talking about. And you've done a lot of online seminars, and Blanchett has done them as well. In fact, it was you, Blanchett, and I forget another third gentleman.
Mike Finca. Uh-huh.
Yeah, y'all did a whole series. And I love that firm. I work with them. We do a lot with them. But I have a little beef in the sense that a lot of these quote-unquote fee-only advisors who are going to this firm and others like it to offer annuities to their clients and be able to still charge on them. Because if you look, I asked this firm, I says, how are advisors charging on these? Chris and I, when we use these products for our clients, we don't charge at all on them. We consider annuities to be a separate asset class. So if you are an investment management client of ours and we've done a retirement analysis for you and we're helping you with what we call positioning, the industry calls it bucketing, but I don't like to use that verbiage for a variety of reasons. So we're helping the clients with positioning. And we charge a flat fee for that. If you want to add one of these annuities, we just consider it an asset class. But this firm told me that most advisors roll these annuities into their AUM structure. And they're going to charge their 1% or whatever it may be. And Chris and I am a licensed insurance producer in the state of Colorado, because most insurance is still sold, especially on the life side. We're big believers in SGUL policies for guaranteed inheritance and estate tax purposes. So I maintain that knowledge and working relationship with commission insurance companies. And when Chris and I started crunching some of these numbers, saying, well, gee, if you had an investment advisor who's going to put you in a commission-free annuity or fee-based annuities, as they're worded, but then roll it into their AUM structure of 0.8% or 1% or 1.5%, it's actually cheaper to pay a commission. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things I'm now having with the industry. They're trying to do something good and open up the door to these essentially investment advisors who refuse to give up their AUM structure. And then these investment advisors can say, hey, we do not earn a commission, but when you look at the fee they're charging, it would have been far cheaper for the life of the annuity for the client to have actually paid a commission. And that, Chris, you can add to it. I know you did a lot of the number crunching. And anyways, that's just one of the things, Wade, I see. It certainly doesn't reflect on you. You're agnostic. You don't push one over the other. You are bright enough to understand the value of secure income, lifetime guaranteed income, especially for what we call minimum dignity floor expenses. But I'm talking about the industry as a whole. I think researchers like yourself, and I think the insurance companies are trying, but they're bucking up against an entrenched brotherhood, if you will, of AUM people who don't want to give up that AUM. And I think it's hurting clients because they're paying more in some cases.
Yeah, I think that's a fair concern because so much of the public perception has been this idea that fee only is kind of the good guys in this whole debate, that fee only versus accepting a commission. But absolutely, if you're paying a 1% annual fee, it's not going to take all that long before that starts to cost more than a 4%, 5%, 6%, 7% type one-time commission. And so ultimately, over the lifetime, there's a well-known financial advisor who runs the commercials about I hate annuities and so should you, and offers to like refund surrender charges on any annuities people have and things. Mm-hmm. Well, how can he do that? It's because the annual ongoing fee he charges is so much more than the built-in cost of the annuity that he's able to provide that refund and still be able to make quite a good profit for himself.
Mm-hmm. We've spoken about him.
Yeah.
We've ran him through the washer and dryer and drove under the bus over him or whatever that saying is a few times on this show. We won't name him, but in the past we have named who he is. But you're correct. Anyways, I just wanted to throw that out there. I didn't want to turn this into a whole tirade. Chris kind of does that on this show. He goes on and on and on. But it's just one of the things that irks me because they are growing in popularity, these fee-based products. I mean, just compared to what I have now to this time last year, it's really opening up. But we, again, just treat them as an asset class and don't charge on them. But when this wholesaling firm who actually does all the opening of the accounts on these fee-based products, they're actually offered a little bit differently than commission-based products, told me that most of the advisory firms are rolling it into their AUM, I went straight into Chris's office and he pulls out the calculator. I just tell him what I want him to figure out. And he started figuring out that, Jesus, this is going to cost more under the way they're doing it. And how can you be a fiduciary if you don't consider both? That, to me, is key. I'm asked all the time, is your firm a fiduciary firm? It just that word is overused now. It's like wealth managers used to be overused in the early 2000s. So now everybody says they're a fiduciary. First of all, if you're selling insurance, you can't be a fiduciary. But it just is being overused constantly. And to me, your advisor should look at both. Here's what it's going to cost under the fee-based, commission-free, and here's what I'm, Mr. Advisor, is going to charge on it. And here's what you're going to pay under the commission approach. Which one would you like? And oftentimes, because there's so little competition right now in the fee-based arena, still 80, 90% of insurance products, if not 95%, are commission-based, especially when we look at MIGAs and SPIAs, which we can get commission-free MIGAs and we can get commission-free SPIAs. But there's so much competition on the commission side. Chris, you'll admit we sometimes find commission ones that pay more.
Yeah, and which is shocking to me, which just kind of leads to the fact, or leads to the conclusion that the infancy of these fee-based or non-commission-based insurance products is just so young, that area of the industry, that we really need some development there. And this issue with the rolling it into the AUM, it irks me as well. I'm glad you brought it up, Jim. And I think the only thing we can do is just continue to use this platform and others who agree to shine a light on it so people understand what the differences are and that they just shouldn't accept, one is just absolutely better than another kind of a situation. They've really got to unpeel the layers of the onion and understand what's going on. Otherwise, they could be paying more than what they're expecting, which is a reason this whole industry, I think, does have a little bit of an image problem with the consumers. We'll just all keep fighting the good fight. I think Wade's on the right team. He's fighting the good fight, doing the research and putting stuff out there that seems to, every time I read something, Wade, to your credit, makes sense, right? So I appreciate what you do, and I know a bunch of our listeners do as well.
One thing I would like to ask Wade then, because before we wrap up, I know we still got like a half hour to go, but a few things that Chris and I believe in a lot that sometimes elicit positive comments from the podcast and negative comments on the podcast. But what I like about your approach, and again, I've listened to you speak a lot. I met you once. You probably don't remember. Or do you? No. You were at the Retirement Income Summit, and you in Chicago, had just come out with your reverse mortgage books, and you were giving some away, and I went up, met you, and you gave me a book, so thank you very much. Oh. You didn't sign it, but you gave me a book, so I do appreciate it. But what do you think, because one of the things we run into, and I was just telling Chris about this today, another person that I know, and again, will remain nameless, I retired at 65, and I just informed Chris today that he passed away 2 weeks ago at 68 from COVID. And according to the people who told me he had passed away, he had no outlying conditions that would have made him susceptible to the disease. And then we have personal clients of ours. One died shortly after retirement, a little over a year. Another one recently died after being retired for 4 years. We see this all the time in our practice because we only limit our practice to retirement people. So we spend more time, Wade, trying to teach people to spend money and to try to get them to spend money with confidence and clarity and comfort. And it's one of the things I like about your approach, especially with your quadrant, because to us, to limit fund spending, if you will, to a safe withdrawal rate is silly because you don't know how long you're going to live. So how do you, or how would you, if you met with clients, I don't know if you do or not, how do you help overcome the emotional aversion to going from accumulation to decumulation? Do you have any thoughts you could share with our listeners? We try to get our listeners to stop looking at their money as an asset and start looking at it as what it is, deferred spending. And we often joke, if you don't believe us that it's deferred spending, take $1,000 of it and give it to a random stranger and watch what they do with it. So it is spending. The question is, what expenses is it going to be assigned to? Discretionary expenses, minimum dignity floor expenses, aging expenses, inheritance needs. But if we can help clients overcome their emotional aversion, I think your quadrant can help that by helping people identify where they fall. But do you have any thoughts on that, that you could share with our listeners how to overcome emotional aversion to spending money?
Mm-hmm. I would say part of that is just, it's kind of the parable of the ants and the grasshoppers, where if you've been saving your whole life and really focused on that goal of accumulating wealth, it can be hard to spend it. And you can't just change to a grasshopper just because you're now retired. But I do recognize this is an important issue. And I think people, they're worried about outliving their wealth. And some people are more worried about that than others. That's actually one of these factors that goes into the RESA, is how worried are you about outliving your wealth? But the way I try to then approach that, well, if you are using a total return investing strategy and you're worried about outliving your money, you're ultimately not comfortable spending much money because you're always going to be worried about it. Plus, there's all these potential spending shocks, like what if you need long-term care and so forth? where you're just kind of worried, what if I need long-term care? I better hold on to my money for that. So the way I approach that in the book, in chapter 3, we're talking about, are you prepared for retirement or assessing your retirement preparedness, is to really lay out, what are the liabilities for my retirement? Like, what do I want to be able to spend on a financial basis? What's a reasonable budget I want to be able to enjoy no matter how long I live? Do I have a particular legacy goal that I want to incorporate? And then also kind of a newer aspect there is to actually model the contingencies. Like with long-term care, if you have long-term care insurance, that could just reduce your out-of-pocket cost. But like, what is a reasonable out-of-pocket cost that you want to feel comfortable being able to cover to then feel comfortable you have enough assets for your retirement? If it's like, I want to make sure I could cover 4 years in a nursing home, projected out at nursing home care rising at 5% inflation every year, and I might move in at age 95 or whatever the case may be, but define a scenario that if you can cover that, you'll feel comfortable. That will give you an additional liability where you need more assets to fund your retirement. But at some point, if you have enough assets to fund all that, including that budget, then you can start to feel more comfortable about actually spending your money and enjoying your retirement. And it's not going to just be the case that your wealth might ultimately continue to grow and grow and grow throughout retirement just because you're afraid to spend it. I do hope that having that sort of clarity around, so everything's not just nebulous. Like, I don't know what's going to happen. I've said these are the things I want to be able to spend. And if I can do that comfortably, then I hope that can help people then feel that comfort to go ahead and enjoy their retirement. Because that's another aspect of, on the financial side of retirement, you kind of have to plan that you might live a long time. But on the non-financial side, you really have to plan like you're not going to live very long at all and make sure that you get the most enjoyment while you still have your health and your life and everything else. And so trying to strike that balance can be a challenge. And just knowing you have the resources to fund your retirement, I hope, can help people to better get the most enjoyment out of those early retirement years as well.
Wayne, I'm glad you described it like that, because that actually, in a little more academic way, describes kind of the thought process and how we came up with what we do. We freely share with people how we do, you know, why we do what we do, how we do it actually. We don't really hold anything back on here on the podcast, like it's some kind of trade secrets, probably why Roger Whitney stole Minimum Dignity Floor. We put it out there for people because we have tons of do-it-yourselfers that listen to the show who never send in as a question to our Q&A show, never maybe contact us, but we know they're out there because the people who do contact us are of that description. So they're out there doing this and having a plan in place, and then identifying those key elements that you need to kind of reduce this trying to reduce that retirement fear, if you will. You've got to have some surety or clarity as to what your future might look like. And everybody's got their own priorities, so they may not have exactly the same types of things that they, quote, need to know is protected. But once they've got that list checked off, those things that really concern them, the things they want to be prepared for, it's amazing we see people then relax. It's you know, we don't see a whole lot of people face-to-face anymore because we remote deliver throughout the whole country, but you can hear it in their voice even when we're talking to them that they, oh, that's okay, we've got a plan for that, we've got a plan for this, oh, that looks like it's covered. They kind of just take a breath and realize now what's left. If that's enough to generate the fun that they want to have in retirement, then they probably are in a good position to retire. And knowing in either the front or back of their mind that these other things, you mentioned LTC, that's obviously a big one, or if they have estate planning goals or something, if there's a plan in place to address those, I think that goes so far in calming people. There's still people who have an emotional attachment to their wealth and still find it hard to spend their own money. But it's not, you know, that's purely then an emotional thing and not a, boy, is there something we haven't planned for kind of a situation. So I appreciate how you walked through that description of identifying that, because I think that's key to everybody, no matter what approach they might take or what income strategy fits them best. They've got to put a plan and look forward and decide what's important for them and what's less important to them, because not everybody's the same.
Right, and that's back to the RESA too. Like if they're working with an advisor who puts them in that total return strategy and tells them to use a 60% stock portfolio throughout retirement, and they're fundamentally never comfortable with that, I think that also can be a source of that paralysis where you're just not comfortable spending because you're worried about a market downturn and you're worried about everything else. And just it's important to have the right strategy along with the clarity of what you are able to fund with your assets so that you're not as worried about outliving them.
Right. And I think that's a good point that if you're, you know, if your advisor or planner isn't addressing the concerns you have, that's probably an indicator that their approach and your style are not necessarily a good fit, because they should be able to answer your particular concerns. Now, they might have a bad answer, like, you know, you're just not financially able to prepare for this. You just don't have the resources. That's an honest answer, not the answer most people would look for. But if they just really aren't addressing it in a way that makes you have clarity or comfort in the answer, that they've really truly considered it and addressed it in a way that makes you feel comfortable, you're probably with the wrong person. That's, I guess, not to put words in your mouth, but that's my version of that. Jim, before we get a little farther, I know we had a couple of questions. We elicited to our listeners, you know, if they had any questions that they wanted us to ask. I think Jim had a couple simple questions that we wanted to get for people since they bothered to send it in.
Do we have time to ask him a real question? Yeah, we still got time to ask him a real question.
Yeah, we can do either one. Okay.
We have a Q&A format, Wade, on our podcast. So we opened it up and we asked people to send us questions that they want to ask you. So we have a couple that they want me to ask you, a few questions. Nothing hard. I think one was, what is your Social Security number and bank account number? And there was another one, but no. On a serious note, the other thing that we say, we just got called out for this again on the show recently by a financial advisor, if you will. And we base this off of a study from Harvard that I'm sure you have reviewed. It came out, I think, 11 or 15 years ago. And Blanchard himself came out with a recent study. And what we try to tell our listeners is that your ability to understand financial concepts, like it or not, does diminish as you age. Some people a lot faster than others, but generally speaking, as we age, our brain does not understand financial concepts as well as it did when we were younger. So we always talk about the need for the younger you. Whether that younger you is 50, 60, or 70s, there's still going to be an older you in their 80s and 90s. So we may feel old, but there's still going to be an older you. And I always say on this podcast and to our clients and to anyone who gives me the time of day and listens that you have to prepare and keep your finances as easy as possible, because as you age, your ability to understand finances is going to be difficult. So using your quadrant idea and that you came up with RISA is RISA, right? Is that what we're calling it?
RISA.
I'm terrible with names, so I'm going to end up calling it something else later. But RISA, what quadrant do you think is the best, or would it be more of a blend? That was going to be one of my questions. Can someone have a blend? Do they have to be in one quadrant, or can they be a mixture of two or three, and maybe some monies are in one quadrant and other monies are in another? But how would using your quadrant approach help people who fear that as they age, and they may not even know it, because that's what Blanchett's study found, is that self-confidence, the confidence that you're doing it right, never really fades, even though your ability to understand financial concepts does fade. How could using RISA help in that case, or not? What do you think on that? And do you agree that your ability to understand financial concepts often diminishes as you age?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, those studies, it's like just taking a basic financial literacy quiz and scores go down at more advanced ages in a way that's not just due to like changing technology and ATM machines or whatever, but also your confidence about your score. It goes up slightly or stays about the same with age as well. It's clear people have a harder time working with advanced concepts of financial, like rebalancing their portfolio, managing a stock market downturn, all those sorts of things. Having to make complex decisions get harder with age. To the RISA, generally, you would be in one of the quadrants. But like income protection still uses a diversified investment portfolio. It's just you don't use the diversified portfolio to cover your, as you say, your minimum dignity floor. You would use more structured or reliable income for that. And then you add the investment portfolio on top. Whereas the total return strategy, you just use the investment portfolio for everything. One area where you could create a hybrid of different strategies would be like, you could have a minimum income floor, so your income protection, but you could also do like a time segmentation strategy where your discretionary expenses for the first 5 or 10 years of retirement might be in fixed income. And then you only have the aggressive investment portfolio for the discretionary expenses over the long term. So that would be a way you could combine strategies. But generally, we think of the four strategies as being somewhat distinct. It's just ultimately they do all include an investment portfolio. So that's where you might see some mixture that way. Then with the cognitive decline specifically, I think that will correspond more with people who have a longevity concern, which is people who are worried about outliving their money or worried about what can go wrong like this as they age. And if you don't have that concern, you're not as worried about it. If you do have that concern, that's, I think the Harvard study you're referencing by David Lapson, he talked about like a simple income annuity as being dementia insurance, that effectively you're less exposed to fraud or theft or making other mistakes if you have a simple income annuity providing you a monthly check, as opposed to having a big lump sum of assets sitting in your investment account that anyone might get a hold of. And the other aspect where I cover this in the new book is just with the chapter on estate and incapacity planning. And it's that incapacity planning that's very important, where you take steps and provide instructions and develop the powers of attorney and so forth to help you in the event of not necessarily, well, especially when there's full incapacity, but even when it's more of a gradual decline where it may not be clear, do you still have your capacity or not? Then some of this planning may be less helpful, but that's where, right, building your plan in advance to anticipate cognitive decline can be helpful in helping you manage that process later in your lifetime.
And you actually, early on in that response, described nearly to a T our general approach, which is the, you know, that safety first commitment, secure income, annuitization piece for the base minimum dignity floor, and then a form of time segmentation for the desired expenses above that. So additional, mm-hmm. a different style of protection. But this really gets at what Jim mentioned with people, you know, you've only got, you know, so many days on this earth, so many days of go-go period, right? And it would be really sad to squander that opportunity once you do retire. And so being worried about longevity issues, having a structure in place so that you can spend freely on the fun, protecting it all, you know, in a different way, but to the same level of effort, if you will. So many people dismiss the discretionary spending as, oh, it's not so important. I can cut that. I can increase it later if I, you know, that kind of stuff. That part we do disagree with compared to the way the industry generally looks at that, in that we don't want people to dismiss the importance of those desired or fun spending discretionary expenses early in retirement, and they should be protected and considered precious, just mm-hmm. like the minimum dignity floor. Totally different issues, though, because the go-go period goes away. You don't have that level of expenses forever. Few people do. Where the minimum dignity floor is going to be trudging along forever until the last day that you're here on earth. So that's why the techniques for protecting it are different. But you nailed it with, you know, our minimum dignity floor coverage with secure income is essentially the safety first commitment quadrant. And then we've got time segmentation for particularly the go-go period of fund spending, and building that structure addresses the kind of people, I mean, that we put that out there as our way of doing things. And we then obviously attract only people who are interested in doing that because that's how we describe doing things. But Jim, do you agree that what he described there is essentially what we do?
Yes. I was pleased to hear that. It lends credence to what we do, but also I think is starting to get people slowly in the industry to understand and clients of the industry to understand decumulation is not accumulation. I often say, Wade, if you use the same investment strategies you did to create your wealth, to consume your wealth, it's not going to end well. You have to, decumulation is much hotter. And I think people, especially people who listen to this show or read your book, will start to understand saving is the easy part. Oh, horror, the market's down. Okay, I'm not spending it for 30 years and I'm investing $1,000 a month. I'm buying more shares at a lower price. Great. But you know you can't do the same thing in retirement. You get reverse dollar cost averaging, sequential risk, whatever you want to call it. And dementia and uncertainty, the emotional risk of retirement in the sense you're not going to want to spend your money. All these different things that hit you in retirement. I think slowly the industry is starting to understand, Wade, what you espouse is not bad. I mean, I've been in this industry 23 years, and when I was at BU studying in the mid-90s, we were told, literally taught, Chris teaches the financial planning program here at CSU, but we were taught in the BU program to hate annuities. And why would you ever want to use an annuity? You're going to invest your client money and you're going to withdraw from it. And we were literally programmed to hate annuities. And for the beginning years of my career, I forget how long it took me before I had an epiphany. I hated annuities. You couldn't, oh my God, I used to go out and meet with the wholesalers, Wade. You know why? They'd buy me lunch. But I would never, ever use their products. And it took a while for me to understand there is a place for a guaranteed stream of income, what you call safety first. And I think slowly the industry and people, not listeners to this podcast because we talk about it all the time, but people as a whole are starting to realize lifetime guaranteed income is beneficial. I call it the bottomless cup of coffee. If you had a bottomless cup of coffee, you're going to drink coffee to the heart's content because it never runs out. But if you only have one carafe of coffee on your table, you're going to limit how much coffee you can drink because you don't know how much you're going to want and how long you're going to be thirsty for it. So we just kind of get people to understand that concept.
Yeah, I think another analogy that fits that too with like the idea of the annuity is that paycheck that, you know, just like when you were working. But it's like if you're driving through the desert and you're starting to worry about running out of gas before you get to the gas station. The worry isn't when you actually run out of gas. The worry is when you start to worry about running out of gas. And that's back to that earlier point. Then you're starting to not feel as comfortable about being able to enjoy your retirement fully. And that's where that annuity can also contribute to knowing that you have that. You're going to make it to the gas station. You have contractual protections to ensure that will happen. And you don't have to rely on the mileage being reported on the car is doing the math to see, is that going to get me the exact number of miles I need to get to make it to the gas station?
Mm-hmm. Perfect. Well, I know we have to wrap up, Chris, in 10 minutes. Did you have anything else to ask, Wade?
I don't know. The only thing I might plant in his mind is, obviously, we can't talk about every possible concept of retirement planning in an hour. Maybe he'd entertain in the future sometime, especially if we had a specific topic to discuss, maybe coming back on the show at a future date after his the book tour is over, let things calm down a little bit. Would you be of interest, not to put you on the spot, I guess?
Well, you just did put the poor man on the spot.
Well,
now his answer is going to be, see, he's going to snip your, be very careful, Wade, before you answer this, because he'll send you the recording. This is what you told us. So think long and hard.
No, it'd be my pleasure. I'm happy. Yeah, there's a lot we didn't talk about. So many different aspects of retirement with the tax planning, the Social Security, the Medicare decisions coming up with open enrollment seasons and everything else.
We focus a ton on taxes, too. As our
and that was one of the questions for Wade that we had. So anyways, we did get a few questions, Wade. Why don't we jump into those while we still have time? The first question, which I thought was really important, what do you think of retiring in Kentucky?
That's where David Blanchett lives.
I know that's where David lives.
Jim, I think it's a fine state.
Jim's eyeball in Kentucky, and he seeks opinions from everybody he runs into. So did that one was signed.
Usually, You see Tennessee on the list of like great retirement states. I'm not remembering if Kentucky usually makes this list. But
Kentucky's not on many lists at all, except for mine. But I was pleased when I saw that Blanchett lives in Lexington. So I was like, wow, we could become neighbors.
That's right.
All right. Well, okay. So maybe someone made up the Kentucky one, but this is a real question. Can you ask Wade if his book is ever going to be released as an audiobook?
Oh, maybe. And I was thinking about it for this one, but this book was so long. I forget what it was going to be, like 27 hours of audio to do it. Mm-hmm. And I'm quite worried right now. Not worried, but I mean, we're going to have tax reform and we don't know exactly what that's going to be. And I thought I'm going to have to put out a new edition with the new tax law. So I didn't want to make the huge commitment to making the audiobook. I think I'm going to start updating some of my other books as well. And I'll experiment with audiobooks with a shorter book first, but maybe so not anytime soon, but maybe someday there'll be an audiobook.
Okay. Well, if you wanted someone with a complete mastery of the English language to narrate your book for 27 hours, I would be available.
That's not so funny for someone who doesn't listen to the podcast.
Side gig. Of course he didn't listen to the podcast.
Wade doesn't know the hilarious irony in that statement right there. So anyway.
You have some experience?
Yeah.
I have a reputation of occasionally muffing up Jimisms or something and mispronouncing words and things of that nature. Anyways, here's another question. I was very excited to hear you will have Wade Fowle on your podcast. I have a question. Can you ask him if I can download his book in the iTunes store? If not, maybe those publications will be available in the future. We iTunians love to stick with Apple for our media, but I couldn't find any way for Wade Fowle's publications on iTunes. I think he hasn't heard of Kindle, but do you have an answer for that?
Well, yeah, if that question's relatively recent, let me check about iTunes, but I do have the book distributed now through all the non-Kindle ebook outlets, I thought. I'll double check about iTunes.
Mm. Oh, okay. Yeah, this came in September 29th.
So it was a week ago.
Yeah, it should have, as far as I knew, it would have been available by then. I don't know if iTunes has something special. I have to actually tell them I want it there, but I thought that was all done automatically through there's Ingram Spark, which is one of the big book distributors, and I distributed my ebook through them and thought that kind of thing was taken care of. So I will check into that. Thank you.
Sure.
Okay. Well, hopefully maybe that listener made a mistake and he can go back and try it again. Okay. But now here's real questions. And it says, given the potential changes in Roth conversions if people have incomes above $450,000 beginning in 2032, how would you advise people in the 37% marginal bracket right now? Do you think we should do Roth conversions even in this higher bracket, which will eventually increase to 39.6 next year? What do you feel will happen to traditional tax planning windows from retirement until required minimum distributions? This is the time most high earners would start to do Roth conversions once they retire. And I guess, Wade, what he's saying is he's worried because as I read the granted, there's no final law yet. And from what I've seen, I haven't read the bill, but I've read summaries of the bill from some very intelligent people and some companies that I pay a lot of money to for summaries. And they said on this provision where you won't be able to convert if your income is above 450 as a married couple, 400 as a single person, first of all, keys off of a different measure. Do you remember what it was, Chris? ATI, I think, was the initials. I can't remember what it stood for. But amounts you convert do not get subtracted out of that 400 and 450 limit, and it's a cliff if you go $1 over. So the very act of converting could push people who may have $100,000, $200,000, $300,000 of income by $1 over this limit, and now they can't convert, but they already converted. and there's no provision to bring back recharacterizations. So what are you going to do if you converted, the conversion pushed you over the limit, and now you can't recharacterize, so you got to take it out as an excess contribution. And granted, the tax implications are the same, but the money's no longer in a Roth. So that was one of the issues we found. But do you have any great words of wisdom running around in your academic brain of what people should do if they find themselves in this listener's position? Should they be converting? Should they chill and wait and see? Or do you have any thoughts on any of that?
I'm familiar with the same things you were talking about, where probably Congress is going to have to change some of that before the final law gets passed, because there is that issue where you could fall into the twilight zone by accidentally converting too much. But more generally, though, this is actually the research area I'm working on right now, with looking more at Roth conversions and thresholds. And if you're going to be in the top marginal tax bracket at that limit anyway, I don't think you're necessarily targeting having a higher threshold for your Roth conversions than that. I don't know how that would necessarily benefit you to be targeting much higher than that anyway, since it's already pushing you into the highest tax rates. And if you're kind of dealing with that level, you're probably already going to be paying 85% on your Social Security income in terms of taxation. So you don't have that opportunity. And maybe there's something with some of the Medicare thresholds. But for most practical cases, I don't think the target for Roth conversions would exceed those thresholds anyway, so it may not be that much of an issue. It depends when you're retiring and how much time you're going to have to do the conversions before your other Medicare, Social Security type incomes begins. In terms of this year, if you're still a high earner at the peak of your career, you probably don't have a lot of capacity there. Any Roth conversions you do, you'll get to take advantage of 37% instead of 39.6%, not including any sort of impact on the net investment income and so forth. But so maybe there's a little bit of advantage, but I wouldn't try to convert everything this year either, necessarily, in most cases. I don't think that $450,000 type threshold for couples will be binding for most people's Roth conversion strategies. I would really have to see a case-specific situation where it made sense to be converting a lot higher than that and then losing that opportunity through the potential change we have in the tax law. It's just too high a threshold to be targeting for conversions, I think, for most people.
Okay.
I agree for most people. I think we are talking about fairly unique cases here, but we've run across a few that might actually, not that we've done tons of projections on these potential tax changes, but as we recall previous tax plans and strategies we've put together, we've kind of kicked around the office, how would this one been a little different with these changes, and would we have done things different? And I think one thing that a lot of people don't pay enough attention to is, doing these tax strategies, if you will, with an eye to legacy or estate planning issues. So I think there still could be some fairly aggressive conversions that if the right legacy or inheritance issues arose, where you might be, playing around in these very aggressive Roth conversion zones, if you will.
But Wade is right, Chris, because even when we do our advanced analysis on conversions, most of the time when Bob, CPA Wade, who does those, you never see him recommending to convert up into the 37 and 39 and 35, even the 32. Most of the time he's in the 22, 24, 28.
It's very, very rare, yeah. There's a couple cases where optimal scenarios showed some really aggressive stuff, but it had very unique timing events involved with it. But yeah, I think it's correct that there's be small subset of people that probably even need to worry about this at this point. But
and do you think, Wade, and this has nothing to do with academics, this would be more of a personal question as we wrap up, do you think, let's see where you fall on this spectrum. Do you think eventually you'll see Roth IRAs go the way of the dodo bird? And I don't mean that they're going to start taxing them, but eventually say no more money can go into them. Do you see ultimately future Congresses maybe going in that direction?
Not necessarily, just because since you have to pay taxes now to put money into them, it kind of helps the government budgeting. The thing that I've always worried about was there's all these provisional income measures, like the special modified adjusted gross incomes for your Social Security and Medicare, extra premiums and things. Someday they could add Roth IRA distributions to those calculations, just like with tax-exempt interest, where you're not paying taxes directly, but it could force you to pay taxes on other things. I think something like that might be more likely than just simply closing them down completely. But at that, I mean, anything's possible now with what the government will do. So I'm not super confident in my answer, but I think that's unlikely.
I never looked at that realm. I personally think that Roths will eventually be closed. I think, is it Peter Thiel, Chris? Is it
Peter
Thiel?
I think his $5 billion Roth ruined it for everyone.
Yeah, there may be no more $5 billion Roth, but I think for those who may have a few million dollars, I don't really anticipate a whole lot of change for that.
Okay.
Any more questions we need to get to, Jim, or is that going to wrap it up?
No, but we'll put Wade in the positive Kentucky location. Have you ever visited Blanchett down there in Lexington? Is it a nice place?
I've been to Lexington before, and I've been to Louisville, and yeah, I mean, the bluegrass state, I've driven around the state, yeah. Definitely. It's a nice state for sure.
Would you retire there?
You're really pushing him on this.
Well, I like to get people's opinion of where I may someday retire to. But anyways, Wade, it was a pleasure having you on. I'm not sure if Chris has anything else he wants to tie up.
No, just want to thank you very much for giving us the time to come on, and we would love in the future to have you on again. We'll come up with a good topic. Maybe I'll email it to you and see if you've got interest in chatting with us about it, and we can just go from there.
And we do have a recording of you saying you would be glad to come back on. Keep that in mind.
Yeah, exactly. Perfect. So thanks a lot, Wade. Thanks to all of our listeners. Wade, you have a great week. Everyone else as well. Jim, I'll talk to you soon. And we'll be back next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.